welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're continuing the second chapter of the second book of the collection called Sea Queen, and this is the 24th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Having cleared the rigging, ropes, sails, etc. from the deck, we laid the two broken ends of the foremast together, after which we took half-inch pine boards, which had served until then as inside planking along the side of the boat. These boards we cut into narrow strips 3 feet long and nailed them side by side around the mast. We then put 5 lashings over the nailed-on strips of wood at an equal distance apart. This is called fishing a spar, and if properly done, the spar will be as strong as ever, which was the case with us. Owing to the lower break being near the deck, it could not be fished very well without enlarging the mast hole through the deck, and as we did not wish to do that, we cut a step on the mast at the lower break, which of course made it that much shorter. It was then about 11 o'clock, and the mainmast was ready to be stepped again. Ever since the typhoon, the talk in the Sea Queen had been in connection with getting the mainmast into the vessel again, and as we had such difficulty in stepping the first jury mast, my two young mates had almost given it up for a bad job, and when I repeatedly told them that to men like us with good hands it was nothing, they replied that I was blowing my whistle again, as I had done about eating raw fish. The mainmast was lying on the deck with all rigging, blocks and gear attached, ready to be stepped, and we proceeded as follows. We took the small jury mast down and used the spinnaker boom for one sheer leg and part of the main boom for the other. We then put on the sheer lashing, 4 1/2 guys and a tackle to raise the mast with. The sheer legs being in place, we set up the fore guy to the end of the bowsprit and the after guy to the end of the boomkin. The lower ends of the sheer legs we lashed solidly to the chain plates. The sheer legs were thus so secured that not even a typhoon could have blown them overboard. The lower block of the tackle was then fastened about 8 feet from the lower end of the mast, and when everything was ready to hoist, and as things then looked very prosperous for the Sea Queen and her crew to get back to Mother Earth, I said to the mate, "By the way, Mr. Stone, just before we put in this mast, we must have a little understanding about the promise you made the other day. You remember when we were in the centre of the typhoon, and just after the mast blew out, you said something about if we got back safely to land, you would treat the crew to a champagne dinner. Now I would like to know if that promise is still good." "I shall certainly keep my word," he replied. "Mr. Vincent," I said, "you heard that?" "I did," said Vincent, "and shall see that he carries it out." "Well, then hoist away on the mast halyard," I said, and up went the mast. Owing to the sheer legs being too short to sling the mast in her balance, we were obliged to fasten the tackle in such a position that the lower end of the spar would just clear the deck when it was hauled down to be stepped. Consequently, when the mast was hoisted up, the top was lying on the after end of the deck and the lower end was sticking up over the bow. Just then the vessel got broadside to the swell and started rolling about, which certainly made it very difficult to step the mast, so by means of our oars we brought the boat head to sea, and then by pulling the lower end of the mast down by means of a rope, it was stepped almost as quickly as I can write it. It was a great relief for the crew of the little boat to see a mast in her again. Of course, it was about 3 feet shorter than originally, and the splice below the eyes of the rigging gave it the appearance of a horse's leg in splints. Still, it was a mast, and we were well satisfied since it was large and strong enough to take us back to land. Our medicine chest still contained some brandy, and we would have celebrated the occasion but for the fact that there was a lot of other work to be done before we were able to set sail again, so we had a little tiffin instead. We then shortened and reset the rigging as before, after which we fished the main boom, repaired the mainsail, which had been badly torn, and also the jib. To repair the rudder, we fastened 2 ropes to the after part of the rudder blade, carrying one up either side of the vessel, and fastened them to the tiller. The mizzen mast being in 4 pieces and therefore beyond repair, our work was completed at 4:30, and the Sea Queen was ready to sail again. Vincent, who had been attending to the cooking during the day, giving us a hand when called upon, sung out, "Come down here, you sailormen, and have a number 1 1/2 cup of coffee," And as the weather was calm, we joined the cook in the cabin and, over a nice cup of coffee and a smoke, decided to sail back to Yokohama, a distance of about 320 miles. Half an hour later, a light breeze sprang up from the southwest, accompanied by light drizzling rain, so we set our reefed mainsail and jib. Under these two sails, and with a moderate breeze, the little Sea Queen sailed along again, almost as if nothing had happened. The rudder also worked as well as ever. The only trouble then remaining was the ever-present perfume of fish in our bedding and most of our clothes, which were saturated with the horrible oil, and since there was no prospect of eliminating the smell, we cast them all overboard. Two blankets were all that remained on board for the accommodation of the crew, and they also smelt so bad that we gave them a wide berth. In an endeavour to remedy this, we tied them to a rope and dragged them through the sea. In the evening, the weather being quite cool, Stone lay down on the bare bunk boards to have a sleep, saying that he would be quite satisfied to sleep on the boards if he only had something to cover himself with. "There is the frying pan lying near the stove," Vincent suggested. "You might use that." The blankets we towed for about 24 hours, but as the smell was as bad as ever, we gave them up for a bad job and cut the rope. September the 4th came in with a moderate southwesterly breeze, accompanied by thick and rainy weather. During the forenoon, the weather cleared, and at midday, by an observation of the sun, I found that we were only about 240 miles south of Yokohama. Owing to our chronometer being put out of action in the typhoon and the strong current setting to the northeast, we were not sure of our longitude, and as the wind had hauled into the southwest, we kept steering by the wind to the northwest to get the land aboard. The two following days, the weather continued much the same, so we kept the boat under small sails, making a northerly course and praying for better weather. During the first and middle part of the next day, the strong southwesterly wind was accompanied by large seas and heavy rain squalls. The boat was hove to under a double-reefed mainsail and a storm staysail to windward, under which our little vessel rode the large seas like a duck. In the afternoon, the wind moderated and the weather cleared up. It was about 3 o'clock, shortly after having shaken the reef out of the mainsail, that, with the little vessel in a fresh westerly breeze making in for the land, I was sitting in the cockpit steering, and on turning my face to windward, I fancied I could smell the land. "Land ho!" I shouted, and my two mates, who were at the time resting on the bunk boards, came bundling into the cockpit and demanded somewhat excitedly, "Where is it?" "I can't see it just yet, but I can smell it," I assured them. Neither of my friends, having stood in the background when those organs were passed round, pointed their smellers up against the wind. After they had been sniffing for a few minutes, Vincent, with more than an element of disappointment in his voice, said, "I can't smell anything." "Neither can I," agreed Stone. "Yes," observed the former, "I'll eat my hat if anybody can smell land from here." And with that, they both dived back into the cabin. The weather was quite clear, and as no land was visible, I became a little doubtful of my own sense of smell. About 20 minutes later, however, I saw a dragonfly circle the boat looking for a resting place. When these flies can be seen, it is a sure sign that land is not far away, and if this was not a sufficient reassurance, I later saw a land bird, and this completely satisfied me. Not having seen anything of the sun since September the 4th, it was a difficult matter to ascertain our position within 100 miles. According to our dead reckoning, we should have been in the neighbourhood of Oshima Island. This is very high land and is visible for a distance of 50 miles. However, while the weather was clear, no land was in sight, and I was not a little puzzled, having made sure of seeing land by sunset. Nevertheless, we continued in a northwesterly direction. Shortly after sunset, the west wind increased to a strong breeze, and the weather became threatening, so as the night was very dark, we hove to till the morning. The threatening appearance of the weather prepared us for another storm, and at midnight the wind increased and was accompanied by heavy rain. But half an hour later, the weather calmed down and the sky cleared. At 1 o'clock it was a dead calm, and with the exception of a thick haze round the horizon, the weather was clear. During my watch on deck, I thought I heard a light rumbling noise. I was listening for the sound again, but owing to the slatting of the sails caused by the rolling of the yacht in the calm, I was unable to distinguish the sound or its direction. I immediately lowered all sails, and then, by putting my ear to the deck, I could hear plainly that the rumbling noise was the sound of surf breakers, and that we were not more than 5 miles from land. The remainder of the night kept calm and fine, and at 4, Stone commenced his watch. It was about 5 o'clock when daylight made its appearance, and almost immediately afterwards, in tones which almost made the little vessel shiver from stem to stern, he yelled, "Land ho!" Coming on deck, I saw, to the west, the summit of a high mountain over dense fog. It was only a small piece of land, but after all our vicissitudes, it was a welcome sight. And to show our appreciation, we all three made a bow, saying, "Good morning, Mother Earth. We are very glad to see you." The calm continued until 7 o'clock, when a light breeze sprang up from the south, and the fog round the land lifted, and on seeing the outlines, we put it down to be Oshima Island, which is 60 miles from Yokohama. We then shaped our course for Tokyo Bay, and as the light wind soon increased, made certain of being in Yokohama the same night. The weather was much the same as on the previous afternoon, fine and clear, and one would have thought that on such a day, high land such as we saw would be visible at a distance of 50 miles, but we were not more than 12 miles away when the island was enveloped in the same kind of mist as we experienced the previous afternoon. At the time, when we saw the dragonfly and land bird, we could not have been more than 15 miles from the island. Sailing along with a fresh southerly breeze, we should, at noon, have been near the Boshu coast, when to our surprise, high land loomed up out of the fog about 6 miles away on our port beam, which proved to be Oshima. That we had sighted in the morning was thus proved to be Miyake Island. However, we were right then, and as the wind was from the south, we would most likely be in Yokohama sometime during the night. At 3 o'clock, when Oshima Island was about 12 miles distant on our port quarter, and the coast of Boshu looming up on our starboard bow, the wind fell light and hauled into the northeast, which was very much against the wishes of the crew of the Sea Queen. Later in the afternoon, the weather commenced to look threatening, with a fast increasing wind, and we kept off for Habu Harbour, Oshima Island. The entrance of this harbour is very narrow, and darkness setting in before we fell in with the land, we hove to under sails for the night. The following morning at daybreak, with a strong northeasterly wind, we steered in for Habu Harbour. On nearing the land, the wind became light, and a strong current setting to the southwest, we drifted to Toshima Island, about 10 miles southwest of Habu. During that day and the following night, we experienced squally, rainy, and misty weather. It was weather that you read about, but seldom see. The current was now against us, but by taking advantage of the heavy squalls which struck us at different times from all points of the compass, we managed to get near the mouth of Habu Harbour by 10 the following morning, September the 10th, and in an hour were snugly moored. We found the village wrecked by the typhoon through which we had passed, and were told by the oldest inhabitants that it had been the worst on record. Besides wrecking their town, it had torn up trees by their roots and sunk a 2,300-ton steamship with her crew of 40 men, but the Sea Queen had passed through the centre of the typhoon and brought her crew safely back to land. With regard to our health, after the hardships we went through, Vincent was in excellent health. I myself, during the typhoon, received a bad cut on my left leg, and not being able to treat the wound properly, I had a pretty bad leg on our arrival at Habu. After that, it soon got well. Stone was still worse off, as at the time when the vessel turned turtle, he happened to be in the forward end of the cabin where our gramophone and a heavy box containing our photographic outfit was placed, and as the boat turned bottom up, these two articles got mixed up with Stone on the round journey. Stone said that when the Queen turned bottom up, it became pitch dark in the cabin, and as the gramophone and box were flying in all directions and made an attack upon him in the dark, he being helpless, the two articles with their sharp edges and corners dug holes into his unfortunate ribs and other parts of his anatomy. The wounds, like my own, not receiving proper attention, had got worse instead of better by the time we arrived at Habu. We had almost given Stone up for a bad job, and it came therefore as welcome news to the crew when we were told by a Japanese doctor at Habu that he was still worth repairing. After remaining a few days at Habu, we sailed under our jury rig to Yokohama, where we arrived safe and sound, and as Stone was true to his word, we celebrated the cruise of the Sea Queen with a champagne dinner. In conclusion, in the appendix I have said much about sea anchors, riding sail, and oil. My readers will no doubt agree with me that they are useful things, but no one can appreciate their value in a higher degree than he who had to rely on these friends at the time when death stared into his face. Sea anchor, riding sail and oil bag, despite their great importance, are apparatus by no means found aboard every vessel and lifeboat, and deserve to be much better known than they have been hitherto. The cruises which I have made in small vessels, not infrequently, have been denounced as foolhardy undertakings. However, when I have given a short explanation, such doubters would become silent. They soon understood that there is still much to be learned about breaking waves, and that there is no better way to study the safety of ocean travel than these solitary cruises on which all kinds of weather and sea dangers are met with and fought. Then I ask, why should not a seaman like myself, who loves the ocean and likes to sail on it, devote his time to this study? The more so as I, for one, feel perfectly convinced in my own mind that I am safe in my small vessel, of which I have complete control, far safer indeed than thousands who race across the briny deep in big greyhounds and have to entrust their lives to the care of others. Captain Slocum, who made a trip round the world in the Spray, a 12-ton yawl, was lost when attempting another long cruise in the same boat. The Pandora, a 10-ton yawl, left Australia on a cruise around the world, and after arriving in New York and having departed again, met with the same fate. Both these boats were considerably larger than mine. The Tillicum and the two cases have been cited frequently as a sure proof that small vessels are not safe at sea. Captain Slocum sailed single-handed and therefore was unable to watch his vessel night and day. The two men constituting the crew of the Pandora have stated that both of them on repeated occasions went below and, like Captain Slocum, left the vessel to look out for herself. A practice of this kind may pass for a long time, but sooner or later it will revenge itself, for the dangers are many if a vessel is not properly navigated and watched. Both small boats, though accomplishing long cruises previous to their disappearance, had certainly proved their seaworthiness. The ill fate they met with was not due to size or faulty construction, but rooted in quite a different cause. Nobody will ever exactly know what happened to them, therefore it would be unjust to blame those who perished and are unable to defend themselves, but I wish to emphasise that human weakness is common the world over, on land and sea, on vessels large and small, and wherever poor management is met with, it originated in such weakness, or, as an English philosopher has aptly put it, the intelligent human mind, face to face with something it downright ought to do, does something else. But for a great many, it is much easier to find fault with others or with the dead material than with themselves. The call of the sea is a strong one. The blue waves and whistling breezes have a never-ending charm to him who spent a life in their company. And though it had been much toil and little gain, it does not make an iota of difference. As I have already stated, I am advanced in years, but still feel confident and strong to venture out on another cruise. I have a longing to visit old places and shake hands with old friends once more. If fortune favours me, and this desire be fulfilled, I shall be ready to conclude my life as a seafaring man. And to all those to whom the ocean is not a barren desert, but a source of life and wholesome joy, I bid a hearty good luck and a fair wind. Well, that's the end of The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. There is an appendix that goes with this book. It's pretty dry. It doesn't really have a plot to it. And therefore, I'm going to read it over on the Mariner podcast so that the seamanship lessons which are inherent in it can be shared with those most likely to put them into effect. Now, for all those who have already done so, thank you very much for your support over on Patreon. We're going to be starting a new book very soon. It's by Frank Woolsey, and it's an account of Shackleton's escape from Antarctica as told by the captain of the Endurance. It's a fantastic read. Whilst Shackleton's account is quite dry and very much of its time, Frank Woolsey's account is much more imaginative and a much greater window onto the adventure that Shackleton and the boys had down there than Shackleton's own words. So that'll be starting very soon. But until then, thank you very much for your support as always. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I look forward to bringing you another one very soon here on the Mariner's Library. Cheers.